I like that sunshine. I don't know about you. I was able to escape some of the cold this week. We had some 70-degree weather in Texas. Sorry you didn't get to enjoy that, but it wasn't that way everywhere, certainly, but it was nice to avoid the 10-degree stuff. But it's that time of year, and so if you're going to live in Illinois, you're probably going to have some of it. Well, Luke chapter 13 is where we are this morning. And verse 6, he spake also this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard. And he came and sought fruit thereon, and found none. Then said he unto the dresser of his vineyard, Behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and find none. Cut it down. Why cumbereth it the ground? And he answered unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, until I shall dig about it and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well. And if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. Okay, so the fig tree in the vineyard. You might wonder, what was a fig tree doing in a vineyard? A vineyard is usually grapes. But apparently it wasn't uncommon in the corners of vineyards to also plant fig trees. If you look in the Old Testament for references to fig trees, it is the reference is abundant. There's much talk about the vineyard and the fig tree in the same frame of reference. And so this was a common tree, and it was valued for its fruit. You like figs? Ever eat a fig? Yeah. Fig Newtons? Are you a Fig Newton kind of person? Maybe not. Well, anyway, so the fig was an important crop, and it was an important source of sugar in the Middle East. In fact, a lot of times references to honey are likely references to a syrup from figs. And we all know how important sugar is in our world. My goodness, it's hard to imagine life without it until you try to eat something that you normally have sugar in without it. I know a lot of people couldn't even begin to drink coffee without it. So it makes a lot of things that are naturally not that good a little better. Anyway, moving right along.
You're fighting an uphill battle there.
Yes, well, you have to admit that a lot of people like sugar in there.
They do.
Yeah, 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 that's true. So.
I did. Before
you got married.
Uh-huh. I gave it up.
Well, just like that. Well.
Could you say that again later when Julia comes
up? Yes.
That wasn't my personality either.
At any rate, figs were important. And so... This parable of the fig tree. Now, figs have they play a role in other places in the gospel as well. You may remember from Matthew the story. It wasn't a parable at all, but the occurrence of Jesus encountering a fig tree that was barren, and it was the time of year it should have had figs, and he essentially responded to it as the Lord of this story was responding to this tree. And it withered. It was, and very quickly, it was. He used it as an object lesson for his disciples just before he was to leave this world, and demonstrating that it was through faith that we had access to the power of God, even when Jesus himself wasn't present here on the earth in the body. Anyway, in this one, we have a little different situation. And this parable is usually understood to be speaking figuratively of the situation that existed in the ministry of Christ and dealing with the Jewish nation. And so we have this number of three here, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this tree. And of course, Jesus ministered for 3.5 years as the Messiah. And so that usually is connected in that way. And it's usually used to communicate the patience and long-suffering of the Savior with those who he came to save. And so even though the fig tree, figuratively the nation of Israel, hadn't responded very well to his coming, to his care, to his tending, yet he interceded at this time and said, well, give it a little more time. Let me in the parable here was, let me give it some fertilizer. Let me give it the care that might bring about a fruitful result, and then the coming judgment will be made as to whether it would continue. Of course, in history, in looking backwards, we often talk about how that hindsight is always 20/20. We know that it was but about 40 years after the crucifixion of Christ that Jerusalem was totally destroyed by the Romans. And we, looking back, can perhaps make connection that there was no way to make by those listening at this point. Undoubtedly, some things Jesus said and did as he taught for the benefit of those later, looking back, looking at his work, looking at his words, they could say, oh, okay, this was in fact a prophecy. This was in fact a foretelling of what was to come. Not likely that any of the Pharisees or those rejecting him in hearing this would have had any clue that he was foretelling their doom. But certainly in looking back, we can see that pictured in a parable like this. But most importantly, I think, is to recognize the desire, the compassion of the dresser of the vineyard, his patience, willing to extend extra effort in order to try to bring about a transformation in the situation. And that, of course, is something we see throughout the ministry of Jesus, his compassion for those that were lost.
Keith, what you said just kind of caused me to think 40 years is usually considered a generation. So it appears that God allowed a generation to go until he put an end to it. And it's also interesting to note, historically, I think from what you said and part of what Josephus wrote, that many of the Christians were either killed or run out of Jerusalem. So it wasn't just that this fig tree is taking up space and using nutrients, but it's not just a parasite, but it's driving out the good trees, pushing them out when they're dying and taking over the orchard, so to speak.
Sure. We have some information to indicate that many of the Christians, in response to the warnings of Jesus, for instance, recorded in Matthew 24, whenever it became evident what was occurring with the armies of Rome surrounding, they got out of Jerusalem. And so Jesus had some specific warnings to those that were believers that destruction was coming. And those that heeded those survived. And of course, the 40 years gave a chance for the disciples to spread the word of his resurrection, of the good news of God's desire to be reunited with men. So once again, the patience and the long suffering of God.
Keith, yes. Reminds me too, just in America here, the first Great Awakening, if I'm correct, I think it happened right before the Revolutionary War, and the second Great Awakening happened right before the Civil War. So for our nation, too, we have experienced the benefit of the gospel being spread in a powerful, abnormal way right before our greatest times of conflict.
Indeed. So this particular account sort of reminds of another Middle Eastern story about trees and fruitfulness. I think I shared this before, but perhaps some of you haven't heard it. So in the Middle East, they had a recipe for curing a palm tree of barrenness. If you had a tree that wasn't bearing fruit, how do you fix it? Of course, in our parable here, the potential solution was, well, fertilize it, right? But here's another one. Quote, "Thou must take a hatchet and go to the tree with a friend unto whom thou sayest, I will cut down this tree, for it is unfruitful. He answers, do not so. This year it will certainly bear fruit. But the other says, it must needs be. It must be hewn down, and gives the stem of the tree three blows with the back of a hatchet. But the other restrains him, crying, nay, do it not. Thou wilt certainly have fruit from it this year. Only have patience with it, and be not over hasty in cutting it down. If it still refuses to bear fruit, then cut it down. Then will the tree..." I'm still getting used to this mouse. "Then will the tree that year be certainly fruitful and bear abundantly." So apparently in the minds of some, trees could hear you, and if you threaten them with being cut down out loud, then you can be sure that it's going to get better. So I don't know if you want to try that with your tomatoes or not. But that, of course, doesn't work with tomatoes. They die every year anyway. Had to be something that was perennial.
I talked to the deer, telling me to stay on my flowers.
The deer, okay. Stay on my flowers or else your sausage.
Yeah. Roadkill or something.
Yes, indeed.
Keith, actually, we found out in our little stint of growing tomatoes that vining tomatoes are perennial.
Okay.
They just normally die because of disease and or freeze.
Right.
But if you keep them in a controlled environment, they'll just keep vining, and you keep pruning it, just coil the vines on the ground, it just keeps growing.
Keeps growing.
Yeah, bush tomatoes will.
Wow.
Okay. Very well. Okay, so the unfruitful fig tree. Luke continues, and he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And behold, there was a woman which had a spirit of infirmity 18 years, and was bowed together, and could in no wise lift up herself. Okay, so this speaks of some sort of physical problem that causes her to be severely bent over, and she can't straighten up. And when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said unto her, "Woman, thou art loosed from thine infirmity." And this word infirmity just means a weakness. And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. And the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because that Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day. And the wording of that, he answered with indignation, sort of makes you want to respond with, "Well, who asked you?" To the synagogue leader. But the term to say that he answered with indignation, it seems a little odd because it doesn't say anybody asked him anything, right? But he answered to this event. So Jesus performed this miracle and he responded. He answered with indignation because that Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day and said unto the people, "There are 6 days in which men ought to work. To them therefore come and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day." Okay, so we have encountered the Jewish perspective of the Sabbath numerous times before, and sometimes we look at the development of Jewish thought on what it is that's prohibited on the Sabbath day. And of course, it gets to be pretty expansive, right? What the rabbis ended up doing is they said, well, anything, any kind of activity that was involved in building the tabernacle is prohibited on the Sabbath day. And so then they went through, there's like 39 different categories of things that were involved in that. And they delineate them fully and carefully. And so the idea of what was permissible on the Sabbath day had, over the centuries, had grown and developed to where that it was quite a burden. And it seems that Jesus has a bit of disrespect for the rabbi's accomplishment in this area. And so notice the wording that he uses in his response. He very carefully crafts this to make them look really bad. The Lord then answered him and said, "Thou hypocrite, doth not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to watering? And ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, not an ox or a donkey, whom Satan hath bound, lo, these 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day?" And when he had said these things, all his adversaries were ashamed, and all the people rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. Okay, so talking about controlling the narrative, Jesus knows how to do it. If you're going to put it in those terms, your position is utterly indefensible, and his adversaries were ashamed. You don't want to be on that side.
Keith,
yes.
For me to read over this, because I've read it so many times in the past, it's familiar to me.
Uh-huh.
What a spectacular event to see something happen that I've never seen before in my life.
Yes.
It'd be a wonderful thing to see somebody physically heal miraculously.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people use the term miracle or miraculously. They apply it to things I wouldn't necessarily call miraculous. I tend to reserve that for something that can't be explained scientifically or in the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
But this would be quite the event, and it would catch my attention if I were witnessing this, and it would cause me to be hyper-focused on this minute because I'd be asking myself, did I just see what I thought I saw happen? Mm-hmm. Is this real? Am I in a dream?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm guessing these people are extremely focused on this woman that's just been healed. If they can't explain any other way by this wonderful prophet who says great things. And then they're faced with the Pharisees wanting to decrease it. And I don't know, I used to think that Jesus was meaning to shame them or embarrass them. I don't know that he was actually wanting to humiliate them as much as it was just to proclaim the truth. This is the unfolding of the truth. This is the way it is. And it hit them hard because it didn't have an answer. They were acting like it was a big deal, but it really wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not consistent with the facts.
Yeah, so what did the guys, the leader say? He says, you've got 6 days to be healed. Don't come here being healed on Sunday. Well, like, she's been in this condition for 18 years, right? This is not something that happened during the 6 days, any 6 days, ever. And so, I mean, how blind do you have to be to say something like that? You've got all kind of opportunities to be healed, right? And you come now. The opportunity to be healed was connected to the presence of Jesus. It's because Jesus came that it's all possible. And so he didn't seem to recognize that. But he was going to preserve his notions of what was religiously proper at all costs, even in the face of God.
This is an important lesson for me. I'm sorry. This is an important lesson for me to remind myself not to put God in a box, mm-hmm. not to dictate what he can do and what he can't do and how he's going to do it. And as you mentioned in the past, not to hold too strongly to something, but to seek truth and be teachable and correctable. Because if I put myself in a position I've got to be right, I'll probably be faced with a situation where it's going to be public.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to be wrong, I'm going to lose face, and it's going to sting.
Mm.
If I don't hold to it so strongly, I can say, oh, okay, I'm better understanding. Thank you. And it doesn't have that sting to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on this journey of seeking God. I'm going to do his will, no matter what the cost. And if I'm wrong, I change.
Mm-hmm.
Continue my understanding, right? And we have to be careful because this is human nature, and we could all be susceptible to this.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Matt?
I identify with the people rejoicing, not only at the miracle, but, you know, the leader of the synagogue, he did create a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But then Jesus was able to counter that. But it rings true when a narrative also, not only does it trump the narrative that's out there, but it also rings true. There is something wonderful about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because so often you hear the person that gets the last word, and you know that's not true, but a lot of people will fall for it. So when you have somebody that can put the truth into good words,
mm-hmm.
and help enlighten people, and then it rings true, that is reality. It is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
It strikes me that the religious leader, what do they call him here?
The ruler of the synagogue.
Ruler of the synagogue. So he's focused, I mean, I'm trying to put myself in his, you know, his head, and he's in power, and it's just a matter of, I am maintaining my power, my position of power. He's not at all, as I think what Bruce is describing, is when we place our trust in Jesus, we're not in a place of power, we're in a place of vulnerability, in following and trying to understand what he wants. And it puts us in a very different position than mm-hmm. that religious ruler was. And I think even some, probably it would be tempting maybe in some religious organizations especially to be like that religious leader, rather than remembering that as a leader, I am also a trustor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different mindset.
Right, and just in general, to position yourself as one who is pursuing truth, trying to find truth, and recognize that I have distinct limitations. Sometimes they're as simple as I just forget. I don't know about you, but I sometimes forget. I sometimes say, if I could remember everything I've learned, I'd be incredibly awesome. But stuff that I spent hours and hours on in college, I don't remember. And you say, well, college was 40 years ago for you. That's true, but I spent a lot of time on it. And I should be able to have that at my fingertips. So I'm complaining a little bit here too. But anyway, I recognize that as a human being, that is the nature of living in this vessel. And so if I don't set myself up in my own mind of, well, I've studied all that and I know now, then I'm able to follow the truth where it leads and not allow my knowledge to be a roadblock to true knowledge, which is a stumbling block.
And you know, it's a tricky thing. I was thinking of being a parent and how our children need a definite answer many times. And it's finding that balance with them that, to the best of our understanding, this is where we stand. This is what we think is truth, what we believe is truth, and here's why. And so you have to be firm and yet open to learn more. There's that constant.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think is very helpful in that regard is to teach them to detect the forces in their life, the voices in their life. Most of us are inclined to be a certain way because of forces from the outside. For instance, if you would compare, and one way to do this quite easily, my parents have a set of World Book encyclopedias from the 1970s, I think. And if you open those books, you see people in public places and whatnot, and wow, they look differently. You know, they don't. It's not what you kind of scenes you typically see on a street now in America. And the thing is, in any given generation, there are predominant forces which are telling people how they need to be, how they need to look, what's in fashion, what's in vogue, what is the right way to appear. And there's a problem as human beings to just responding to all those forces from the outside. If you in fact are committed to following Jesus, you can't be following everything else. Is that obvious?
Yes.
Yeah. To follow, first of all, means you stay behind. but you can't follow two people at once unless they're both going the same way.
True.
And I think surely you've caught on that most of the world is not going the way of Jesus in the least. And so we often approach the best path in life from the standpoint of, well, as long as something's not wrong, I can do it. So in other words, I can do what I want if it's not wrong. Well, that's not really the message of Jesus. The message of Jesus is the only right way is to seek the will of the Father. It's not about The world, life is not a playground for me to exercise what I want as long as I stay out of trouble. That won't lead us into the straight gate that he's going to talk about here in a little bit. And so once we begin to realize in life that a lot of my wants in life are generated not from my understanding of what's good. They're generated from pressure from other people. They're generated from media, from advertisement, from fantasy. People see a movie or a picture of somebody that attracts them, and they're like, I like to be a part of whatever it is they're doing. I want to connect with them in some way. I want to identify so that I'm like that because I like the feeling, the idea of it. They haven't a clue whether that's a good thing or not. They haven't a clue where those things lead. But they're willing to basically trash all of the heritage that they were given, all of the generations of accumulated wisdom that are part of their background, because I'm attracted. I want. It seems positive to me. Well, we have to teach our children that attraction is not equivalent to good. Sure, you're a human being. Things attract you. Things that sparkle. Things that glitter. Things that are flashy. They're attractive. They catch your eye. If I'm in the woods crossing a creek, a lot of times I watch for stones that are unique or arrowheads. I've actually never found an arrowhead in the creek, but it's like, well, it might be. Never know. But certainly rocks that are unusual catch your eye. Sometimes I bring them home. My wife has a collection of those somewhere, I hope. When I'm in far-off places, we went to the West Coast, and I brought back some things from the ocean side there. I brought back a rock from an ancient volcano in Oregon one time. I think it's still in the backyard somewhere.
Somebody's going to declare something happened archaeologically because they find that in your backyard.
That's right, right. The glaciers brought it here from Oregon. my point is, as human beings, there are things that catch our eye. But are those things worth changing your life over? Are they worth departing, separating from those that love you and that have given themselves for you over? Is that attractiveness the God of your life? That's a problem, if it is. And so it turns out that some things are hard to identify distinctively as good or bad, as right or wrong. But if those things come into your life by way of desire, in other words, if your only interest in them is because you have been influenced to want, that's intrinsically a problem, whether the thing itself is good or bad. And yet we have this simplistic notion that, well, if it's good for somebody else, if anybody can do it, I can do it. Right? The idea that the goodness is in the thing somehow, or as long as it's not bad, then it's permissible. Well, you've totally ignored the fundamental mechanism that causes us to go astray. Our pursuit, our constant pursuit of wants, of fantasy, of notions that lead us away from the goodness of God. And so I think it's important that we make that distinction in the conversations. There's some things that will actually harm you that you may not be able to prove are bad. But looking back later, you see, this was taking me in the wrong direction. This was feeding that pursuit of mindless desire that is a part of human experience.
And Keith, is there another step too in this case? So the ruler of the synagogue on a given Sabbath needed to keep order and needed to make sure things ran according to, if he just let anybody anytime come in and do whatever, he wouldn't be doing his job. But in this case, he didn't recognize he was what he saw as good and right and normally was actually interfering with what God was doing. And so then he was opposing God. So sometimes, maybe, you know, people have said that sometimes good gets in the way of what is best, in a sense. So most of the time, that is what you need to be doing. But if God is doing something else, you need to be willing to get out of his way. In my case, I recognize a lot of times where I struggle is if I have a sense of this is my kingdom and my responsibility, but then you overlook the people it's affecting, or, you know, the other things, other factors that come in. Well, you do have a certain responsibility to maintain order and keep chaos out, but if that takes precedent over what God wants you to be doing, how he wants you to be dealing with somebody or something, or, you know, then it's creating stress, undue stress, because I'm taking it all on my shoulders. This is my responsibility. I'm going to do this. Then I'm not trusting him. I'm not. Mm-hmm. So something that is, in a sense, good becomes...
Yes, I think that's a valuable insight. I might add this, that you don't want to be in a position where you have to justify your action on the basis of, well, this is my territory. I have a right to do this. That's not very persuasive of somebody looking for truth. It's valid enough in one sense, but children in particular don't find that a defendable position. It's hard for them to tell their friends, well, I have to do this because my parents, this is their territory, they have a right to tell me, and I'm doing it because of that. I mean, at some age that works, but you want to connect to higher goals, higher realities, higher responsibilities, higher demands than this is my territory. You know what I'm saying?
Keith, I don't think it's that far when a person says, why can't I do this? To the point of, I want to do this, and they find a reason to do it. I'm thinking about myself. I hope I'm past that. I hope I put that away from my life. But that is a danger.
Yes, and so... I mean, I think what I hear what you're saying is that if you're asking the question, why can't I, you probably already want to, right?
And it's easy to find a reason that it's okay.
And the implication is if I can't find a reason why not, then it is okay. Instead of saying, why would I want to do this? Where does the desire come from? Am I like a child that's responding to the sucker? Or to the advertisement or the picture, it's flashy, it's attractive, I want it. Is that what's going on? Or is there in fact in my life a depth of desire for true good that I see a good here that is beyond that?
was faced with something like that in the past week. And it was a situation involving money. Of course, money's important to us because it allows us to do things and help other people. And I was faced with the opportunity to save some money. I had to buy and seed. And explain to Laura why I was going to do something and how it was justified. She said, I understand what you're saying, but some other people may not see it that way. Is it worth your reputation to save that amount of money? I said, no, it's not. Because even though in my mind it seems right, and I could explain it to others, and a reasonable person would say, yes, that's fine. If some people don't understand it, and it affects my ability to speak Jesus into their life, it's not worth it. Mm-hmm. No amount of money is worth that.
Yeah, and you know, the level at which we have to make this decision changes a lot of our lifetime, right? You're no longer attracted so much to the sucker or the flashy picture, but there are plenty of levels of life at which we all continue to have to be making those decisions about what is good. So, you never know where Luke will lead us. I'm blaming him here. Yes. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry.
No.
I think we can all identify with this, with the news media that we face today.
Yes.
We have a news media that is antagonistic and hateful of God and his values. And if they were to do a story of any one of us in this room, they would show us to be awful human beings because of our trust in Jesus. We're willing to do what we understand to be right. They make fun of us. They try to shame us and hurt our reputation. Mm-hmm. And yet, this is the message that's coming out in what's so-called legacy media. An outflowing of our culture. I think back to a poll that was done in the 1980s. And before I mention the poll, I'll say this. We as Christian people speak out against sin. We're very gracious and quick to forgive people who are sinners and who have sin. Our complaint is when people justify that sin and say, it's okay, and you should do it too.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we have a problem, and we dig in our heels and say, no. In the 1980s, a poll was done of people that were hired in the what we call legacy media, the major news offerings at the time. And well over half of them said that adultery was okay. It was morally okay.
Mm-hmm.
What that says to me is you have over half the people, this is back in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
This is recent.
Sure.
More than a generation ago. Let's say it's okay to willfully break a covenant with somebody, to mm-hmm. hurt them. And we're going to affirm that and say, that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
If the person's willing to willfully go against one of the sacred agreements that we can encounter as humans,
mm-hmm.
what wouldn't they allow? And so it's no surprise that they are so hateful to our Christian values, and yet some people who have television and radio will turn on the television and they'll play it for hours and they're being fed this tremendously biased and prejudiced view, where the media is giving out some facts, being deceitful, and sometimes outright lying about what's going on. So when we hear a podcast or we hear somebody that's coming out of that saying, no, I've changed, or this isn't correct, this mm-hmm. is the truth, it's so refreshing to say, finally, somebody's speaking up against this and pushing back. And I think part of it's why we were so encouraged and surprised at the outcome of the election.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that there were that many people that cared and saw through both the lies and the falsehoods and said, well, we need some change. We're going down the wrong path.
Mm-hmm. And, unfortunately, it occurs to me that we face new challenges. So all the reports are is that the legacy media is just about done. I know one particular channel The report is they've lost half of their viewership since the election, and they didn't have much to start with compared to the more conservative ones. But on the other hand, it can be popular to be a Christian. One of our clients in Texas was reflecting on this whole thing, and he's like, you know, I talk to people and they're like, oh, I was praying for this. And he's like, you were? He says, do you pray for anything else? their life in general hadn't reflected a life of prayer. And so, you know, that's something not to forget. Just because everybody's buying Bibles and talking Jesus doesn't mean they understand him and have truly embraced his way of life. Now, that's not to say you're never good enough for us. It's just caution. don't be taken in by the trends, whether they're up or whether they're down. They can lead you astray in either case. He's the standard. He's the one you stay close to, no matter whether it's popular or not.
I had an immediate thought after we won, and I posted something like, you know what? We've been given a merciful chance. We better take advantage and not, you know, just take it for granted. Because I think there are a lot of people who are like, okay, now I can breathe easy and do what I want. Wait a minute. That's not what this is about.
Right.
We've been given a window maybe of opportunity to really help people.
Sure.
Root out corruption, but
more
responsibility.
Yes. So, being human beings, we have plenty of things to distract us in any environment, and so it is important that we stick closely to the task of following Jesus.
I think it's good to ask a lot of questions. Even when I read news reports that might be favorable to my position or what I think, mm-hmm. I still ask questions and I ask, is this real? Are they giving the full story? A lot of times I'll do background checks, even sometimes looking at what the legacy media has to say or doing fact checks online, because I don't want to just read what goes along with what I think or supports what I think. I want to know the facts, because if I speak out and I talk to people, I want to make sure that I got the facts.
I'm with you there. Absolutely. Well, this was quite a notable miracle that Jesus did. And it seems, as we read the Gospels, that he often got into difficulties with the leaders of his day by performing these miracles on the Sabbath day. And perhaps even somewhat intentionally, he did that. And incredible response here that he makes to this particular situation. And all the people rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. Well, it's 11 o'clock, so I'm out of time, and I'll stop right there. Thank you for coming and listening this morning. Thank you.
breaking, how we need to hear from God. You've been promised, we've been waiting. Welcome, Holy Child. Welcome, Holy Child. Hope that you don't mind. Take our sin.